Hello and a very warm welcome to our podcast, Was tun? In our show, we are discussing the pressing political issues of our time from a strategic perspective. We talk to activists and ask them what their strategic learnings are, how other social movements can benefit from their experiences. And in this episode, we're talking to the Brazilian activist and philosopher, Rodrigo Nunes.
We are Valentin and Inken, and we like talking about political strategy, and we are doing this podcast now to share our discussions and learnings with you.
Our guest today, Rodrigo Nunes, has been active in various social movements, first in Brazil and later on during his studies in the UK. And in his new book, Neither Vertical Nor Horizontal, he reflects upon his activist experiences and builds a theory of political organization.
Yes, we talked to him about his experiences, about organizational forms, about something he calls organizational ecology. And I was really inspired by his ability to think political praxis together with theory, or like to put it into theory.
The conversation is somehow really a backward and forward between an analysis of the political situation and more abstract theoretical questions.
Yeah, so I hope you find the talk inspiring too, and have fun.
Yeah, enjoy.
We are sitting in a little flat in Kreuzberg, and we are very happy to now meet Rodrigo Nunes, who is on his travels through Europe to present his book, Neither Horizontal Nor Vertical, and talk to activists and theorists about matter of organizations. And it's a very nice summer day. We're sitting inside, so you can listen to the talk very well. But yeah, we have a great view over Kreuzberg, and I'm very much looking forward to the talk about strategic questions of organizing.
Hey, Rodrigo, great that you are on our show, and welcome to Was tun.
Thank you. Thank you very much for the invitation.
Rodrigo, like, how did you come even to the questions of organization? Who are you as a political person, and what are your personal experiences with organizing?
I guess I could say that I've been doing activism for longer than I've been doing philosophy. I guess you could say that one of the key ideas that I develop in the book, which is the idea of organizational ecology, the idea that organization always exists in an ecology of different organizations, but also of unaffiliated people who are in the sphere of influence of these organizations, but also people who just might act together with one another without any kind of coordination from any permanent structure of any kind. Maybe one of the sources of this idea for me is my experience in several different forms of activism. I started out in student politics in Brazil. Then I joke that one day the anti-globalization circus moved into my backyard, because I was living in Porto Alegre in the south of Brazil at the time, and the World Social Forum started happening in 2001. So I was involved in the organization of the World Social Forum, which allowed me to meet lots of people in Europe who were involved in the anti-globalization movement here, which was great, because a few years later I came to Europe to do my PhD, and I already knew lots of people. So I was involved in anti-globalization politics in the UK and in Europe in that period. And then afterwards, in 2006, I think, a very good friend of mine who's like an international organizer, really amazing organizer, who's worked with service employees and migrant workers in the US for a very long time. She came to London to set up a campaign working with cleaners first in the London Underground and then in the buildings in the City of London. And she said, oh, you speak lots of different languages, you have experience organizing, why don't you come and help me set up the campaign? So I did that for 10 months, and it was a very formative experience for me, which I guess left me with this sense that, you know, there's lots of different functions that need to be fulfilled within a social movement, both in practical terms, there's lots of different things that need doing, but also in political terms, there's like lots of different fronts in which a movement should be, a healthy, winning movement should be fighting. And this diversity is an advantage. And that is if you can make the best use of it. So I guess maybe one of the sources of this idea is precisely the fact that I've gone through several different functions and in several different, very different political and organizing spaces over time, while also doing a PhD in philosophy.
Today you have a professorship in Rio de Janeiro in Brazil. And yeah, maybe could you tell our listeners a little bit, tell us what the current situation of social movements in Brazil is today. I think it's very interesting to hear a little bit from a different context than Germany.
It's a very good question. I wish I knew what the answer was. This is a very interesting, but also a very weird time, because obviously the last 4 years have been terrible for social movements in Brazil and Brazil generally under Bolsonaro. But at the same time, there is, so on the one hand, with the perspective of the presidential elections later this year and what looks like a very likely return of Lula, there is this hope that, you know, at least the worst will be over after the elections. And of course, there is this very positive memory of Lula's period in power and just, you know, the very positive perception of Lula as a very charismatic leader who, you know, was a worker, became certainly the greatest Brazilian political leader of his generation and one of the most important of all times. But at times I fear that people, in ways that are perfectly legitimate, perhaps because the last few years have been so bad, but that people believe that, you know, once Lula is back, everything will be okay, which is not true. Among other things, because the situation in which he will be coming back will be very different, both in terms of domestic Brazilian politics. Now you have a large and very mobilized far-right social base. You have a bunch of political actors in the center of the political spectrum, center-right political actors, who won't refrain from trying to use this far-right social base to their own ends. But also the economic situation internationally is completely different from the one that PT found at the start of the 2000s, in the beginning of the international commodity boom. And even if there were a commodity boom now, we really would need to question Brazil's position in it to the extent that, of course, you know, given the evidence of climate change, the kind of economic and political wager that PT made at the start of the 2000s would be very, very questionable now. And on top of that, there really is a reckoning that I I would say still needs to happen in terms of the relations between social movements and the Workers' Party in Brazil, because the Workers' Party has, you know, it's a lot of the major social movements in Brazil, they emerge together with the Workers' Party. They have a very intimate, a very organic relationship. But this also meant that when PT was in power, there was a big push to demobilize these social movements and stop them from demanding more. I would argue that was one of the things that put PT in the position it found itself in 2016 when Dilma Rousseff, who was Lula's successor, was impeached in a parliamentary maneuver. Because this is something that I argue in the book that's just come out in Brazil last week, which is a book on Bolsonarismo and precisely these impasses that the Brazilian left finds itself in now. The problem with the argument that people in PT often make that, you know, it's impossible not to make concessions is that people seem to be assuming that there's like the right amount of concessions and you make those and then you find yourself in equilibrium. And that's not true because the conditions of equilibrium are changing all the time. And if you're not trying to change those conditions of equilibrium in your favor, the likelihood is if you're not trying to make yourself stronger than the people you're making concessions to, in all likelihood, you're going to find yourself having to make more and more concessions to these people. And that's what happened to them in 2016. And that's a reckoning that I think still needs to happen within Brazilian social movements.
Yeah, it's really interesting. I think we're having different, but in that kind of similar situation in Germany right now, where we have a strong conservative opposition to the government, but basically no left opposition. And so the, like what you're saying, the equilibrium, oh, that's a hard word, in which kind of the consensus is being made is, or where the middle ground is being found, is kind of also shifted to the right, basically.
I have one additional question. Sure. Today, you are teaching as a professor of philosophy in Rio de Janeiro, and you told us that at the moment you are mostly teaching political theory to the students, and I'd be very interested to hear what kind of questions seem very relevant to your students. What are the specific demands for critical theory, for like what is the hot stuff in the current situation?
I wish I knew. Well, as I was telling you, I started at my institution at the Catholic University in Rio right after the 2013 protests. So at that moment there was, and a lot of the students, most of the students had participated in the protests. Mm-hmm. So at that moment, there was a lot of demand for talking about and thinking about democracy and forms of participation, but also organization, because the problem of organization was posed very quickly within those protests. On the one hand, people had this idea of what was the ideal way in which they should organize. So we should be horizontal, we should be leaderless, etc. But on the other hand, they had the experience that A, they never really managed to achieve that. Like you knew, you could tell in these informal settings who the more influential people were. You could tell that there were forms of hierarchy they were very hard to address precisely because everyone was supposed to be horizontal and on the same level, etc. But also, I think people could sense very quickly in the context of those protests that, well, we thought this was how you were supposed to organize, but this doesn't seem to be working. Mm-hmm. This doesn't seem to be doing what we expected to do with it. So I guess, I don't know if the students were lucky to have me or I was lucky to have the students, but that was precisely the moment when I started. And seeing people go through that experience in Brazil was one of the reasons that made me decide, yeah, this is the project that I'm going to work on. I'm going to work on a theory of political organization because there's a demand for it now. But the other thing in my department is we were the first department in Brazil to create a research cluster on philosophy and climate, and it's called Philosophy and the Environmental Question. And so it's known for that. The person who set up this cluster, my colleague, Deborah Danowski, who you might know from a book that she wrote with her partner, Eduardo Viveiros de Castro, which is called The Ends of the World. It was published in English a few years ago. Actually, I translated it into into English. So a lot of people come to the department expecting that, which again is great because the new project that I'm working on is on the concept of transition. So there's lots of students who are interested in discussing precisely that at the moment.
Cool. Yeah, I think it's very interesting what you said, that sometimes the ideal of horizontalism precisely makes it so difficult to address hierarchies that emerge in every organization. And to go back to that question of organization, you're arguing for a theory of political organization. And I think in a very practical sense and also discussion sense in Germany, we also know the Organisationsfrage. So like, I think horizontalism always had a little more difficult stand in Germany than in other countries. But like, what do you mean by that theory of organization?
Well, one of the things that I realized in just now, I realized that I narrated my decision to start working on this project as, you know, me saying back in 2013, I'm going to write a theory of political organization. Actually, that never happened. It was only years into working on these questions that I realized, you know what, there is no theory of political organization. No one has actually done a theory for it, at least not in the sense of what I understood that a theory of political organization should be. Usually when people talk about the Organisationsfrage, actually what they're talking about is the party. And so you have theories of the party. The problem is the party is, you know, we have empirical evidence of this around us every day, is only one form that political organization can take. And therefore, I thought a theory of political organization must be a theory that's capable of talking about all these different forms, but also about the about how these different forms interact with one another, about how people who don't belong to any organization interact with one another and act together or interact with existing organizations. So in fact, the point of departure for a theory of organization shouldn't be a single organization and shouldn't be prescriptive, because the other thing that always seemed to be implied in discussions of political organization was it seemed to be the case that people just assumed, without questioning this assumption, that the question of organization was the question about what is the ideal organizational form, what is the organizational form that everyone should have, or perhaps at the limit, what is the organization that everyone should belong to, which is the question of the party. And I thought, no, a theory of political organization rather than starting from a single organization, it must start always from an ecology of organizations and of people acting collectively that don't belong to any organizations. And it must be able to think, first of all, the kind of organization that exists outside and around and between organizations. And secondly, if it's starting from that position, if it's starting from the assumption that organization is always plural, is always diverse, and always exists within an ecology, then it cannot be a question about what is the ideal organizational form. You know, you just assume that there's going to be several different organizational forms. And then what you have to ask is, well, what are the functions that these different forms perform? Which of these functions are essential to a winning, successful movement? And how can an ecology of organizations or an ecology of organization fulfill these forms? Which is a way of voiding, in a way, questions such as the question of the party. You know, when people talk about the party, when people talk as if the party were a necessity, what they're basically saying is there's a number of functions that need fulfilling, and they assume that the party is the only thing that could fulfill them. Mm-hmm. And the question is, well, yes, you're absolutely right. There are some functions that need to be fulfilled. Is the party the only form that could fulfill them? Could we have a party to fulfill some of those, but not all of those, and have those other functions be performed by other parts of the ecology? So this was the kind of question I was asking then.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. It really reminds me actually of a model that we sometimes use when we do strategy trainings with groups. There's a model, it's called movement ecology, where you kind of try to map what maybe for, like, for example, for in the climate area, what organizations are already existing, what's their aim. And I think when I often think of it, it's more like what level do they address? Do they address people or the government or something? But it's also, I think it's also interesting to think about it in terms of how are they organized internally. So that's what you do more.
Yeah, when we discuss these questions of organization, I always have to think about this like grand debate between Rosa Luxemburg and and Lenin, where they discussed exactly this question somehow between verticalism and horizontalism. Yeah, we already briefly touched upon these concepts in the interview now. Could you maybe explain a little bit more the philosophies which are attached to each of these concepts to help us understand a bit more this whole idea behind, on the one hand, verticalism, and on the other hand, horizontalism? Because my impression is it is not only about how we organize, but it's also a way of thinking, a way of perceiving politics more generally. Mm. Yeah,
I described it. It just so happened that while I was writing, or while I was finishing the book, I was also translating into English a book by a Brazilian philosopher who, it was one of his last books, and towards the end of his life, he was working a lot on Ludwig Wittgenstein. And I realized, because I was working on that translation at the same time as I was finishing the book, that something that I was doing in the book could be very well described in terms of what Wittgenstein called therapy, a therapy of language, in the sense that what I was looking into was precisely the conceptual grammar that people used to think of questions like organization, spontaneity, self-organization, etc. By which I mean, what are the unspoken assumptions here when we employ these concepts, and are these assumptions useful, or are we actually carrying a load of baggage in these assumptions that's unhelpful to us? And I describe the method. Again, this was, sadly, I'm not one of those very systematic philosophers who sets out with a very clear idea of what the method is and just employs that method. Usually the method I'm working in or that I'm working with becomes clear to me after the fact, sometimes even after the book has already been published. So I tend to describe what the way in which I was working, without it being entirely conscious to me at the time when I was writing the book or when I was developing the ideas that are in the book, as moving downstream and upstream constantly, by which I mean there were problems that I knew from my own practical experience in politics, in organizing, or that I could see other people having, like what I was just describing with my students after 2013. So practical impasses, practical dead ends that people encounter all the time. And it's really funny when I'm talking about the book to an audience and I mention one of these problems that I look around the room and there's lots of people nodding their heads and, you know, they all know what I'm talking about. So that would be downstream. And from there, I would move back upstream to the conceptual grammar that was involved in the way in which people posed those problems. Because the idea was precisely, well, there is a conceptual problem here upstream that if we solve, these problems will stop appearing, or they will appear in a different way. We will be able to pose them in a different way, in a way that's more tractable, in a way that, you know, in which they can be solved, or in a way in which we can at least recognize, actually, they don't have a solution, which means we'll just need to work through them forever, which is ultimately, I'd say, a better solution than trying to find the perfect solution and then being constantly frustrated that you can't find it. So to give a practical example, one of the, and this has been a source of misunderstanding, I think, for some people. I've heard some people say, oh, you have a very strong critique of spontaneity in the book, which is not true. I have a critique of the grammar that is usually involved when people talk about spontaneity or when people talk about self-organization. I mean, for starters, if you just think of it, there's something very funny in the way we talk about self-organization, because usually if you add a prefix to a word, it means you're qualifying that word in a certain way. It means you're introducing what Aristotle would call a specific difference, which means precisely that you're specifying a broader concept into something narrower and more precise, which means that the narrower concept is a species of this broader genre. But in the way in which we use self-organization a lot of the time, it is as if self-organization were the opposite of organization. So we have something that is part of something bigger, but it's the opposite of the something bigger that it's supposed to be a part of, which means that people assume that organization is, you know, if you oppose organization to self-organization, it means you're implicitly assuming that organization is always organization by someone else, organization from the outside, organization from above. And it was precisely this kind of assumption that I wanted to question. Actually, it's a lot of the time, it's not that clear where outside and inside are, or it's not that clear who is the other. And I was telling you just a few minutes ago that I was thinking about that text, It Takes Organizers to Make a Revolution, yesterday. Because when that text came out, it came out with a picture of a film by Podovkin called The End of St. Petersburg, which is a picture of workers, just workers, talking to one another in the process of making the Russian Revolution. And I remember a friend at the time saying, oh, that's a great text, I loved it, but it's funny that the picture contradicts it, because he assumed that if I was saying it takes organizers to make a revolution, I was making a distinction between organizers and workers. Workers were one thing and organizers were a different thing. And precisely what I was saying is, within the workers, there are organizers. Like, there's organizers everywhere. Nothing happens if there aren't people who are actively building the collective infrastructure through which it can happen. But because people automatically assume that an organizer is an outsider, he thought, well, there's a picture of workers, so that picture contradicts the argument you're making. I never told him that, but yeah, I wanted to say, oh, thank you so kindly for your comments, but actually you misunderstood my
maybe
point.
Maybe he's listening to the podcast now.
Oh God, yes. Just send him the link.
Sorry.
Hey, der Was tun Podcast ist ein kleiner und unabhängiger Podcast. Wir hören aber immer wieder von unseren Hörern, dass er total hilfreich ist in ihrem Aktivismus und dass die Debatten über politische Strategie die Leute in ihrer praktischen politischen Arbeit tatsächlich weiterbringen. Wenn du uns dabei helfen möchtest, dass wir noch mehr Menschen erreichen, dann lass uns doch bitte eine Bewertung da. Das kannst du direkt machen in der App, in der du den Podcast hörst. Vielen Dank und jetzt viel Spaß beim Weiterhören.
It seems almost as if some people misunderstand self-organization as disorganization. So in this case, they see the workers and they say, oh, wow, so these guys, they are organized. They're not disorganized. So it can't be some kind of self-organization in a more narrower sense. Mm-hmm. Another text that I really, that I found very interesting that you wrote is, or another term, is this idea of organization of the organizationless. Could you maybe dwell a little bit on this and tell us what you mean by this?
So one of the major assumptions about political organization that I was arguing, that I realized I needed to argue against, is the idea that political organization is rare, which is, you know, if you think about it in, you know, the that this is absolutely explicit in Marxism, you know, there is the social organization of protests, things like, you know, the peasant wars in Germany, what was his, Münzer, which someone like Eric Hobsbawm would describe as pre-political. Mm-hmm. Then you have the economic organization of the working class in trade unions fighting for economic questions. Political organization only begins the moment the workers realize that they need to fight not only for better economic conditions, but for political power, and they organize themselves in an instrument to fight for political power, which is the party. So the assumption is political organization begins with the party, begins the moment people become conscious of their political goal as being, you know, we need to take over political power and we need to take over the state. Funnily enough, this is an idea that is shared by both, you know, the way I'm describing it, this could be like the, you know, a very orthodox verticalist version of Marxism. But funnily enough, this is an assumption that's shared by horizontalists as well. The only thing is, they invert the signs in the equation and they say political organization begins with the party, therefore we should avoid the party, we should avoid organization. And this is how you arrive at the conceptual grammar that everyone was employing around the time of the Arab Spring and the Indignados and Occupy, where people systematically described what was going on as being, you know, these are movements without leaders, without organization, so on and so forth. One of the things that I was working on at the time was the work of a French ethnographer who worked on Brazilian indigenous people. Well, the Guarani, which occupy the west of Brazil, and nowadays the west of Brazil and Paraguay and, yeah, more or less the center of South America. And he started his most famous work, which is called Society Against the State, by saying, well, we define indigenous societies as being societies without history, societies without the state. So we define them negatively by what they don't have. But what do they have? How can we describe them positively? And this is what struck me when I was teaching this text. It struck me that you could say exactly the same thing about what was going on at that time. You know, we're hearing this is leaderless, this is organizationless. Well, what is it then? And obviously my argument was, it is already organized. It is organized in its own way. You can describe the organization that is there. It's just not what you're looking for. And because you're not finding what you're looking for, you think there's nothing there. And then you're missing what's really important about it. So organization of the organizationless was a way of arguing precisely, you know, these things that you say aren't organized, it is possible to describe the way that they're organized. And it is a way in which people are organizing without organizations, without traditional mass organizations. But this doesn't mean that it's not organized, because, and this was ultimately the broader theoretical point that I was working towards, anything that you can say anything about is organized in its own way. And it should be possible, if you know what you're looking for, or if you know where to look, instead of just going there expecting to see something, then you should be able to understand what's there.
I think it's really interesting that, in a way, like these movements in opposition to very like hierarchical or very virtualist societies kind of went into the other organizational extreme, basically, by saying, no, we are none of this. And that means we are organizationless, because they kind of equated being organizational with being vertically organized.
Exactly.
However, I have actually, I have two questions, but I will ask one of them first. So maybe could you tell our listeners a little bit about what you found in between, like the horizontal and the vertical? Because I think you also say in your book that you also said that it needs ecology. But maybe just to give our listeners a little bit clearer idea of what is an organization if it's not horizontal, or if it's not solely vertical.
I've one of the things that happened when the book came out was I had to deal a lot with people making the joke, so it's diagonal.
It's a little bit funny.
Which is, it's really lucky that I didn't use the word diagonal, because then diagonal was taken up by people here in Germany, like the conspiracy theory.
Yeah, it's true.
So it was a really lucky choice not to use the word diagonal. Since then, the daughter of a friend of mine my friend asked her, so what do you think? What is neither vertical nor horizontal? And she said, wiggly. Which I thought was a good answer. And then another one which I've heard, which is actually a very good answer, is lumpy. And actually that is a very good description, because another encounter, theoretical encounter, that was important in the process of developing these ideas was my encounter with network theory, which was something that I'd been interested in. Actually, when I was writing my PhD, I already had the idea that I wanted to write a book on organization, because I had a first encounter with network theory, and I thought there's stuff to do here, there's stuff to be thought here, and also because already at the time, this would have been, I don't know, 2005, I was already encountering the limits, the practical limits of the forms of organization that I was used to and that I was working within, and yeah, that I try to elaborate and to think through in the book. And in network theory, you can start from an opposition between, you know, two extreme models of what a network could look like. So you could have a decentralized network. But if you're talking about a decentralized network in absolute terms, this means a network in which no node has more connections than any other node, which means, among other things, that it's a network in which it takes forever for information to travel from one point to another. Because what creates what physicists have called the small world effect in networks is precisely the fact that if you hit a very well-connected node, then information can travel much faster to other parts of the network. So that would be one extreme. The other extreme would be a centralized network. But if you're talking about a centralized network literally in absolute terms, then this means a network in which there is one node in the center and all the other nodes would only connect to one another through this node. Obviously, in the real world, in the natural networks that develop, that emerge spontaneously in nature, neither of these things ever happen because they're both very bad systems. You know, you have, on the one hand, you have one system in which it takes forever for information to travel. On the other hand, you have a system where if you take one node down, there is no connection anymore. So you have a third model, which is the model that actually describes most of the stuff we find in the world, which is called distributed networks. Now, the important thing is that distributed networks describe a range between the absolutely decentralized and the absolutely centralized, which means that, you know, you could have a distributed network that tends more towards the centralized, or you could have a distributed network that tends more towards the decentralized, but basically everything in between is distributed. And in the process of learning about that, I realized actually this gives you a very elegant way of bypassing what's perhaps the oldest problem in philosophy, and the problem that is basically that comes back every time we're discussing, you know, the movement versus the party, autonomy versus hegemony, centralization versus decentralization, so on and so forth, which is the problem of the one and the multiple, or the one and the many. Because what happens in a distributed network is that, on the one hand, it is many, you know, there's lots of things within it. On the other hand, there are ones. There isn't a single one that connects or organizes the whole network, but there are bigger nodes that play a more important role in terms of connecting the different parts of the network, of distributing information. If we're talking about an organizational ecology, you know, these would be, for example, organizations that are more influential, that have a larger sphere of influence. So an ecology is never simply dispersed. So what I'm arguing in the book, someone in the talk that I was giving at Humboldt yesterday, in the Q&A afterwards, a person said, "You oppose the ecology to the party." And I said, "No, precisely, I don't do that. Because the question of the party for me is, you know, the problem with the party was, the problem I have with the idea of the party was the assumption that the party should become the whole of the ecology, or the whole of the ecology should be subsumed in under the party. But within an ecology, there are parties, objectively, and they could have very important roles to play. But they could have important roles to play as one part of the ecology and not as the whole."
Yeah, I find it very interesting how what you just said, Rodrigo, connects back to the beginning of our talk when we discuss the difficulties of social movements who unite completely behind the party as their ultimate
representation
in parliament somehow, because then once the party is in government again, they don't have a say anymore. Whereas if we think about it more in this distributed ecology sense, then maybe there's also strategic advantage when it comes to relating to our own parties once they are in government, if it's clear what I mean.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. I remember an event that I was speaking at in Athens in 2015, it was a crazy time to be in Athens because it was exactly the week in which Syriza capitulated to the EU. But Jody Dean was at this event, and my friend Paolo Gerbaudo and a bunch of people were at this event. And there was this one panel in which people like Jody Dean and Paolo were arguing in each in their own way for the party. You know, Paolo from a populist perspective, Jody Dean from a communist perspective. But everyone was excited at that moment because of Syriza. Everyone was still excited at that moment with Syriza. But also Podemos, who had appeared just a little bit before and, you know, with great promise, with a lot of expectations. So everyone was talking about the movement party and how we needed to move towards the movement party. And at one point I told them, look, I think it's great that you're talking about this, but you think it's such a great, perfect solution because you're coming from places where it doesn't exist. I come from a place where that exists. PT is, you know, it's 100% a movement party, at least it was in its origin, and it has its own problems. Mm-hmm. And, you know, I'm in that sense, just because of historical and geographical contingency, I'm one step ahead of you. I know where this is going. I've seen it. I'm living through it. Mm-hmm. And one of the things in the book, one of the references to the Brazilian context in the book that comes back a few times, which again was very formative for me, more through indirect experience, through my mother's work and, you know, stuff I read and people I met, etc. But liberation theology was extremely important in all over Latin America. And it was, and people don't understand this as clearly as they should, even in Brazil, perhaps, how absolutely crucial to the existence of the Workers' Party and the movements around the Workers' Party it was. Like Lula, all the initial trade union leadership in PT, but also the leadership of the MST, the Landless Workers' Movement, and the leadership of a bunch of other urban movements that appeared at the same time. Everyone had been initially formed politically in the ecclesial-based communities set up by liberation theology. Mm-hmm. And why was I talking about liberation theology? Oh, yes. I was talking to this person in the south of Brazil who was like, and one of the things that happened to liberation theology that, again, many people don't realize was that, you know, when we had an anti-communist pope, Karol Wojtyla, whose pope name was John Paul II, one of the things he did was to completely dismantle the structure that had been created by liberation theology and to persecute the leaders of liberation theology within the Catholic Church, etc. And I thought that this was basically the reason why liberation theology more or less disappeared in Brazil, which has been a great problem for the internal health of PT, because, of course, if you'd had a structure that kept creating popular leaders, then you would have like this constant challenge to the party and to the internal party structures, etc. And I asked him, was this what happened? And he was like, yeah, this was very important as well. But at the end of the day, we all worked with the idea that we were working towards the party. The party was the telos, was the destination that we were working towards. And once we had the party, we thought, okay, our work is done. Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
You know, we can, now everyone moves into the party. Now everyone becomes a party member and political activity becomes channeled through the party. And then we started abandoning the organizing work that we were doing. And he said, I now realize that that was a huge mistake and we're paying the price for it now.
Hi, sorry für die kurze Unterbrechung. Du hörst den Was tun Podcast. Und wenn dir gefällt, was du hörst, dann abonnier doch jetzt den Podcast auf Spotify, Apple Podcasts oder wo auch immer du ihn gerade anhörst. Vielen Dank und dann viel Spaß beim Weiterhören. I have like two thoughts. I hope I can weave them together now. I think it's really, really interesting how you're making the argument of how different basically organizations need to live together in the network movement, basically, or in the movement ecology, like in your example, how the smaller communal churches of the liberation theology churches kind of produce the popular people, the popular leaders to always go into the party again. And I think that's a pretty good connection to the model and something that I find very smart about the model of thinking of organizations as networks, that then if you kind of have that model in your mind, it's not like it's an organization in a frame, but it's an organization that's on multiple nodes, always open to other organizations, and kind of is able to connect to other organizations in the ecology. And I think that's really interesting, and it makes a lot of sense that if in that ecology everyone is concentrating on only one organization, then you get a problem, because also the equilibrium in the move in the ecology is not working anymore in a way. I think it's really, that's a very...
Yeah, you don't want anything to be too big to fail.
Yes, and I think that's something that I also had to think about when you said also like in thinking about how centralized basically the organizations are able to be structured or should be structured. It's always like a thing about finding a good place between effectiveness on the one hand and resilience on the other hand. And that's basically the axis maybe between which the different organizational forms can evolve in a way. Yeah. One thing that I find really interesting, it leads back again from Brazil to Germany, is that when we were talking now about vertical organizations or centralized organizations, we were talking always very much about parties. And I have like a curious case in mind for this, because we have one very new movement actor in the climate movement right now. They're called Aufstand or Die Letzte Generation. And they are people that are doing also actions of civil disobedience in order to get politicians to act against the climate crisis. And they are organized extremely vertical. Mm-hmm. Like the movement where I'm coming from, it's organized more or less horizontal, like or people try to organize not too hierarchical.
Don't
but
fall into the trap of false dichotomy. Dichotomy?
Dichotomy, probably, right. But I find very curious about this new organization, that they are organized very centralized, like there's a plan, basically, that's followed by everybody, and there are only a couple of people that are doing like the strategic work and decisions. And I find it really interesting because it's a new movement actor that's actually taking on organizational forms that we associate with parties.
So maybe to make it a bit more concrete for you, so these guys, they are like blocking streets and they are gluing themselves on the streets so the cars cannot pass by, and they call their organizational model functional hierarchy, which means that there is like a grand plan they have, like the committee somehow has, and they are then looking for activists who write their name and their address and like their contact details on lists, so they can just mobilize them on specific dates. Wow. So on one of these action dates, everyone who has put his or her contacts on this list will get an SMS saying, come to this place and glue yourself on the street.
Come to this place, bring super glue.
Yeah, and then they do it. So, when you hear this, what are your thoughts from like an organizational perspective?
It's a This is very similar to the Extinction Rebellion model, right?
Yeah, they are also connected.
But you do have Extinction Rebellion in Germany as well, right?
Well, I think, so we had Extinction Rebellion, and I think now parts of Extinction Rebellion merged into this new organization.
Right, right. Yeah, it makes sense. There's probably only room for one of those in the ecologies.
So. Yeah.
I do discuss this in the book to some extent, though not directly. Extinction Rebellion was one of the things that happened while I was already writing the book, and then I didn't have the time to engage with more. I actually read a fair bit about it, and I read a bunch of very good critiques of it. But I ended up not, I don't remember if I even mention it in the book. But, no?
I don't think so.
You clearly know the book better than I do. But one of the things I say in the book is that if we were to identify a organizational form that's characteristic of today, this would be the platform. And I describe it as, I'm not the only person describing it as a platform. I'm actually, one of the people I'm taking that idea from is my friend Jeremy Gilbert, who's got a book coming out soon that he wrote with Alex Williams, where they develop this idea a little bit more. Basically, the idea is, what is a platform? Well, if we look at the major commercial private communication platforms that we have, you know, what is Facebook or what is Twitter? Basically, the company sets up an infrastructure for collective action. In doing so, it conditions the kinds of results that you will get. So, you know, we now have plenty of information and plenty of evidence of how the algorithms, say, in YouTube condition certain results and how people become radicalized into the far right through the algorithm of YouTube. So that this infrastructure conditions, but it doesn't determine the result. You set up a platform for people to collaborate within. By doing so, you kind of establishing some limits, but you're not determining exactly what people will do. And again, you can think of this on a sliding scale. So on the one hand, you could describe the kinds of protest movements that we had in the last decade, which I describe as the decade of mass movements without mass organizations, as being platforms in and of themselves. So you set up, you know, some people, because people used to do, you know, a lot of the discourse on those protests talked about them as if they happened by magic, as if it were like, I always imagine, you know, those scenes in musicals where like a whole crowd in a street just starts singing and dancing in sync with one another all of a sudden. And reading the media at the time, it felt very much like this is what it was. Obviously, you know, there were people who worked to set up the date, to set up some kind of minimal infrastructure, to have like a slogan, to have a general idea. But then they didn't have a social base. They weren't like a trade union or a mass party who could say, okay, everyone now go and do this. So they were inviting people to come and cooperate and act collectively within this framework that they had set up. And then the result was something they were not going to control. So on the one hand, you can have a platform that's very open as to its results. On the other hand, you can have a platform that is more restrictive as to its results. And I think what we've seen first with Extinction Rebellion and now, what's the name of this movement again?
Last Generation.
Right. Right. Yeah, I've heard about it. Is the other the other extreme of the spectrum, where people are becoming more aware of, you know, this platform way of operating and are making a clearer pitch to people in terms of, right, this is the idea, this is the plan, these are the people who decide what the idea is and the plan. If you want, come and collaborate within this framework. And I think people are into that. Because first of all, one problem that you always have with platforms is precisely the moment when you go, you know, this is an open space that everyone can make their own, to at some point down the line, it will always happen, the people who set up that space will say, actually, we had a clearer idea of what we wanted to do with it, and this is the direction in which we want to take it. And then everyone who was invited to cooperate is like, well,
why didn't you tell us?
Do we get a say in this? Because now we're part of it. Don't we get to participate? And there's always that tension. You've seen it happen with like Momentum in the UK. There was a bit of a crisis moment for Momentum. Yeah, you've seen it happen, I don't know, with UK Uncut, a bunch of other experiences like that, which could be described as platforms that were that came into existence and sometimes also out of existence in the last decade. I think one of the advantages that this Extinction Rebellion model has is that the ask is a lot clearer. You're saying from the start, look, you don't get a say here. You don't decide strategy. We decide the strategy. But I think many people will be up for that because A, they recognize the need for strategy, and maybe they recognize the difficulty in coming up with collectively with a strategy in a situation where you have, you know, a very diverse group of people who are very young, who have little political experience, etc. So they're happy to trust like these charismatic older men who already have a plan. But also it's a clearer ask in the sense that, you know, you know from the start what to expect. There's always this ambiguity in platforms where it's like, on the one hand, oh, this is open and free for all, but actually it isn't. Mm-hmm. So if you're saying from the start, you know, it isn't fully open, but, you know, we're telling you now and you can make your own call about that. And I think the third thing is, this is actually a model of collective action that works very well for the situation that most of us live in today. Like, you know,
we most don't of have us time to go to meetings.
Exactly.
Yes, it's
exactly.
Very effective.
Most of us, you know, most people are super precarious, working several jobs. They are very, or working and studying at the same time. They are very time poor.
Yeah.
So you outsource all the time that would be spent in meetings, deciding strategy, etc., which is enormously time consuming, and it's something that people hardly ever discuss about horizontalism. It's like, you know, you need to have a lot of time to be involved in a 100% in a process that tries to be 100% horizontal all the time. So yeah, it's very practical for people.
It's a little bit like it's a good organizational model for a neoliberal society.
Totally.
In which
yes.
People are just not like, time is a very, very precious good of most people, precisely because of the reasons that you just outlined. And so in this form of society that we naturally want to overcome at some point, but is it just practical, as you said, for many people to organize that way? One thing that we have talked a lot about also in the podcast is the notion of organic leaders, for example, and of individuals performing in a way special roles in a movement. And I'd be interested what your view on notions of leadership, for example, but also other roles in these organizations is.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, leadership is actually a very important concept in the book. And one of the ways in which I describe what I tried to do with the book is that I was trying to write a new operating system that could run some of the old software that we inherited from previous generations and from, you know, the Marxist tradition, the anarchist tradition, whatever. but could run them in a different way. So, you know, I thought there's something too important in an idea like leadership, and in an idea like which I employed in a deliberately provocative way, the idea of vanguard. They perform important functions that we lose if we ditch them altogether. And the point is then, you know, how can we clean these concepts from like the metaphysical and political baggage that they've acquired, that they've accrued over the years, and make them work again for us, and make them work in the way that we want them to. One of the main concepts that I was trying to do that with was the concept of leadership. If we go back to that story I was telling you about the friend who commented on the picture that came with my text, It Takes Organizers to Make a Revolution. How is, you know, if you think about a spontaneous between scare quotes, unionizing drive in a workplace, like, you know, what we're seeing in the US now with Amazon and a bunch of examples like that. How does that happen? And again, we need to question the assumptions that usually come with ideas like spontaneity, because precisely what spontaneity does is make these things completely mysterious. But if you look at them, if you look at what happens is, you know, one day one person talks to another person and says, you know, the conditions we're working in are ridiculous, we should get together to fight for different conditions. Yeah, that's a great idea. Let's talk to so-and-so. And then so-and-so says, oh yeah, I can bring these other people, let's have a meeting. And then you have a first meeting, and the people who attend the first meeting will invite other people. So actually you have, everything always starts from somewhere. Mm-hmm. You know, nothing comes, the problem, one of the big problems with the way we normally employ a concept like spontaneity is precisely that it makes the most banal things sound completely mysterious, because it's like, oh, it's spontaneous, it just comes from the ether. Again, it's like a musical, everyone starts singing and dancing all at once. So what happens there, you know, with the first people, the first two people who have the conversation, and then the, you know, the next couple of people that they have the conversation with, and then these people go and talk to other people, blah, blah. This is a process which in network terms you could describe as a process of diffusion. You have something that happens in one point, and then it starts being diffused across the network. We have a word for describing that process in like social and political settings, which is leadership. And leadership, in that sense, is an absolutely crucial function within an ecology in which nothing ever fulfilled this leadership function, or what I call provocative, admittedly in a provocative way, the vanguard function, in an ecology in which nothing fulfilled the vanguard function, nothing would ever happen. Mm-hmm. There would be no novelty. There would be nothing ever. So this introduction of a novelty, of a modulation of collective behavior that's going to cascade, or that's going to spread across the network, is the most minimal sense of leadership. Leadership precisely as a function, which is often confused with leadership as a position. Now, leadership as a position of leadership is something that can, that might develop out of the function of leadership. It may be that those first people will become, you know, will be recognized as the informal leaders of that group. And it may be that eventually, once they've joined the union, then, you know, they'll become a hired organizer for the union. And increasingly, they'll have a position of, an increasingly stabilized, recognized, and eventually even formally recognized position of leadership. So obviously there is a connection between the two things. People have legitimate concerns about positions of leadership, because the problem of positions of leadership, if they become too stabilized, if they become too rigid and too fixed, is precisely that it ends up inhibiting the function of leadership across the network. If now you're expecting all initiative to come from one place, or even worse, like the person occupying this one place only allows initiative to come from them, then precisely this function that you need, which is the function of introducing novelty, of making something new appear, becomes concentrated in one place and stops circulating. So again, the ideal scenario is a scenario in which you have positions of leadership, which is kind of inevitable, because, you know, they are the stabilization of these processes, which is actually an idea that you will find already in Max Weber, this idea of the charismatic leadership being like the original form of leadership. Except in my case, unless we use the word charismatic in a much broader sense, like in my sense, it doesn't even have to do with charisma, or it doesn't even have to do with personal characteristics. A lot of the time you have no idea who started something, or it makes no difference. But the ideal scenario is a scenario in which you can arrest the process of transformation of a function, of the leadership function, into positions of leadership, precisely in order to maintain things in that sweet spot where you still have nodes that play a more important role in the network. And, you know, it's important that we have them, because they have more experience, because, you know, they are respected by their peers, because, you know, they are better organizers than other people. But without that becoming too rigid, because then you have room for that leadership function to circulate.
Yeah, I think that's really interesting, because you always get a problem in institutions, and I'm kind of thinking about German unions right now, also when the position of leadership gets disassociated with the function of leadership. So, like, as you said, leadership now, it's more like giving impulses. And sometimes when institutions grow very old, the impulses are not coming from the positions of leadership anymore, but from, as you said, some nodes in the network. Sometimes we don't even know from where exactly. And then people with the position of leadership can even stop the like real leadership or the function of leadership from happening. And I think it's also speaking like now in a more thinking about how to do things in a good way, like to think about these positions of leadership often, I think, helps to think them more in a way of initiating processes, or like to see them more in a service to the community and to the organization kind of way than in a leadership and impulse kind of way, because often you can't take that role of giving impulses to only one person in a certain position. It just, that's not how it works in a way. Yeah.
So maybe to round up the interview, we talked about lots of interesting stuff about political organization, political strategy, activism. As you know, our podcast is called What Is To Be Done? And so at the end of the interview, I would like you to give somehow advice to people in movements, how they can try to employ or apply your theory of organization in their activism.
If you're thinking about strategy, pay attention to everything else that's happening. Pay attention to what everyone else is doing. And then think your strategy in terms of, you know, how can this strategy piggyback on stuff that's already happening that other people are doing, but also how can this strategy reinforce stuff that other people are doing, or where does this converge with what other people are doing? Where are the points of tension? And, you know, it's all right. Like, one of the points of thinking about organization in ecological terms is precisely that ecology is a form of unity that does not exclude competition. But the point about thinking ecologically is you don't think exclusively in terms of competition. Mm-hmm. You don't start from the idea that, you know, everyone is your enemy because everyone is competing with you for who has the prize ticket for the revolution. History is an open-ended thing. It's a very heavy object. So, you know, none of us, however big our organizations might be, etc., none of us can move it on their own. So we're going to need lots of people trying to move it for it to move in any direction. What direction this will be, none of us can really control. So, you know, let's look around and see, okay, what's the general direction we can identify in which we're all sort of going? And let's act in such a way that, you know, everyone will get closer to where they're trying to go.
Mm-hmm. Thank you. I think it was a great interview. Thank you for demystifying some of our ideas about movements.
Yeah, and I'm also looking forward to the next book, which I have a suggestion for the title, maybe Lumpy and Wiggly.
Would be great.
Or neither Lumpy nor Wiggly. It will be yet a third thing.
Or Beyond.
Beyond Lumpy and Wiggly.
No, thank you for the interview. It was great meeting you. And yeah, I think there's lots to think about.
Likewise. Thank you very much for the invitation. And it's been a pleasure. And I hope the listeners will think the same.
Me too.
Great. Thanks so much.
Hi. Now it's Valentin and me again. And after the interview, we always try to gather loose ends and try to highlight things that we think that other movements maybe can learn. Yeah, so Valentin, what are things that stuck with you?
Well, I think one question that I had in mind before doing the interview was this: okay, it's neither vertical nor horizontal, but what is it then? Yeah, it must be something in between, but at least from the title of the book, it's not very clear. Mm-hmm. What the neither nor then gives us. Mm-hmm. And here the idea of the network was very informative for me and very interesting. Also the way in which Rodrigo really sketched out what he means when he talks about the network by giving us these two ideas of, on the one hand, a complete horizontal network where none of the knots in the net has more connections to other knots than the others, mm-hmm. as like the one extreme where it's extremely difficult to diffuse information and in political terms to organize, mm-hmm. Whereas on the other hand, in this like very centralized network, mm-hmm. every knot is connected to the center and only to the center. So if the center breaks somehow, then mm-hmm. there is no network anymore,
yeah.
And so it becomes somehow fragile,
mm-hmm.
and so the way in which Rodrigo talked about the idea of distributed mm-hmm. organizing and distributed collective action in this network form helped me to understand what he means mm-hmm. by talking about his theory of political organization.
Mm-hmm. I think it's also interesting that he connected to that very often the notion of functions in the network rather than the notions of positions in the network, which I find really interesting because it means that for organizations to work, you need certain functions to be fulfilled, but they are not tied necessarily to certain positions or to one outlet that an organization can have.
Yeah, so for example, when it comes to leadership, leadership then becomes more like an ephemeral phenomenon instead of this thing which is attached to, let's say, for example, a charismatic leader as a person, right?
Yeah, I think that's really interesting. And it's really, I have it very like visualized in my mind now, which I think is really nice.
Like how leadership somehow travels then
through the network.
Across the network, right?
Yeah. One thing that's also tied to that I found really interesting was his example about the liberation theological into like smaller places that recruited into the party. Because I think it's really, really interesting to also look at different organizations in the ecology and how they relate to each other. And that oftentimes, in order for one organization to work, you need different ones around it that either bring new people in or do the educational work on the margins or do other things. And I found that really interesting because it really makes big the idea of an ecology, but it also allows individuals to travel in the network without kind of getting lost once they leave an organization.
Yeah.
And that I think is... It also really relates to my personal experience, but it's also a really nice way of thinking about it.
Yeah, on this point, there was also a very interesting bridge between the theoretical analysis and somehow like the practical political situation we are in, and that Rodrigo also described for Brazil and the PT, the Brazilian Workers' Party, how it is very necessary that there is such a thing as an organizational ecology that persists even when, let's say, for example, as a party, as one kind of political organization comes into power to somehow hold them accountable, for example.
Yeah. It's really, that's really, really interesting for the whole ecology. And I think now when we zoom into one organization, I think Rodrigo was very keen on not giving certain advices on how to do the best organization, because I think he also thinks that it doesn't exist. And in each organization, you will face problems at some point. But thinking of designing an organization, I found the trade-off between effectiveness of an organization that's fairly centralized and the resilience of an organization that's more decentralized are very interesting, and to have in mind that both of those are really important. One of them might be more important for an organization or for one particular organization than the other one. But when you think about designing an organization, to kind of to have that in mind and kind of account for both of these attributes.
Yeah, definitely. Yeah, I think this thought about like there is not one political strategy, there is not one organizational form that everyone should adopt is very central to his argument, and is really like a key takeaway for me as well, that we should not think about movement politics as this kind of like competition that is just about one prize and the one team that has the right answer to the strategical challenge then is somehow winning the competition. I think this is very key.
Yeah, it reminds me of a friend of mine who always said, we all have a different theory of change and we don't know whose is right.
Yeah.
Which I think is kind of a similar mindset.
Yeah, but I mean, in addition to this, it's not about like that there is even such a thing as one strategy being right, but rather this idea of convergence or different roles or this is also something that I agree. On the one hand, we don't know which theory of change is right, and sometimes of course there is such a thing as a better strategy and a worse strategy, but also we can have different strategies and feed into unifying goals.
Yeah, I think the only thing that I would add to that is you need a unifying goal, and it's also not enough to, sometimes I feel when we talk to people that are doing politics, there's a mindset developing that's similar to There are different functions and different places in the ecology, and each of it needs to be occupied, and then all of us will be successful together. And I think it's just also important to note that that's not sufficient. But if you're working in the ecology, you still need a goal and you still need to move into a direction in order to also change something and not only sustain the ecology.
Yeah, and also there is definitely also a point where this whole like organizational ecology or political ecology kind of thinking has its limits, right?
Yeah.
Sometimes it can become an excuse for not having difficult discussions, for example, or for not having to disagree on stuff. And so, yeah, I think there's also like a spectrum.
Yes, definitely. Yeah, and then I think the last point to the organizations, I just talked about designing organizations, and one thing that also stuck with me was the idea of a platform, like organization as a platform for politics. And the platform doesn't determine what's the outcome politically, but it does set the frame, basically, in which, or the basis, probably, in better words, on which the political possibilities of that organization can grow. And so I think it's just to be mindful of an organization and of an organizational structure you set up and what kind of politics it makes possible.
Yeah, so yeah, for me, there are lots of takeaways, as you can tell from the conversation that Inken and me are just having. And I hope that you enjoyed the conversation as well, that you could learn something from it, and that maybe there are some ideas that will occupy your mind for a little longer. And so, yeah, thanks for listening to Was Tun.
Maybe until next time.
And have a great time.
Bye.
Das war der Was Tun Podcast. Konzept und Redaktion Valentin Isen und Inken Behrmann. Schnitt Julian Schwumberger. Die Musik kommt von Richard Waterman.